Well, what do we do with wives submitting to their husbands and being the weaker partner? Why don't we just rip this page out of the Bible? Can we not do that? It's a bit old-fashioned, isn't it? Why don't we just glue the two pages together then? And so when we get back to 1 Peter, we just skip across this passage. Probably not a good approach to reading the Bible, is it? So let's see what we can make of it. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the Apostle Peter. We thank you that you, by your Spirit, can help us learn what it is you want us to learn so we can live as Christians in this world, in this time, in this culture, for Jesus' sake. Amen. I need to explain a little bit of background to 1 Peter, and particularly for those of you who might be visiting here together, and then try and come to this passage in particular. You've got to remember that when Christianity was first preached in the ancient world, it was obviously a new message. Preachers like the Apostle Peter, who's written this letter, and the Apostle Paul, who's written much of the rest of the New Testament, they were going around the ancient Mediterranean area talking about a Messiah called Jesus. And people were hearing this message and starting to believe in this Messiah, and they were saying that they were willing to change their lives completely, even die possibly for this new Messiah called Jesus. And this raised suspicions in the minds of those who weren't Christians that Christians were revolutionaries, that they were radicals and were going to upset the whole of society. You see, Christians talked about being free from the law. So did that mean they were going to become law breakers? Christians said you can't serve two masters. So did that mean servants would run away from their human masters? And a big fear was that if women became Christians, they would leave their non-Christian husbands. So it added up to a lot of suspicion that Christians were not going to be good citizens, that they were going to disturb the settled order of society, and they were going to disobey authority. Now that's why Peter goes to such lengths in chapters 2 and 3 of this little letter, telling Christians how to live under authority. And in essence, he says that Christians are not to be revolutionary, they're actually to obey the laws of the land and to live under the human authorities that have been placed over us, whether that be a government that runs a country or a boss that employs us. And Peter points out that this is in fact following the model of Christ, who submitted himself to the human authorities that were over him, even though it led to his death. So belief in Jesus, therefore, does not lead Christians to overturn authority, but actually to work under authority. And Peter points out that this is good for countries, it's good for workplaces, it's good for families, and it's good for churches. Because if you don't do that, you then have anarchy. And also, when Christians act like this, when they obey the authorities, when they live in harmony with one another, it's actually a good witness then to the world that might be accusing them or not understanding them. It shows then that Christians are peace-loving and respectful people, not revolutionaries and anarchists. Now that's the background to this section of today from 1 Peter 3, in which he will speak in the first 7 verses about wives and husbands, and then in the next few verses, verses 8 to 12, about relationships in the church. I'm going to comment briefly on both the sections, and then I'm going to interview a couple, Steve and Kate Heady, who've kindly volunteered to help me today, and they're just going to give us a little perspective on how this looks for them as wife and husband. So first of all, let's have a look at these first 7 verses on wives and husbands. Now, the idea that wives are to submit to their husbands was actually not controversial in Peter's time, because it was taken for granted that the husband was the head of the family. Peter is simply presenting a model of husband and wife relationships that comes from the Old Testament, as you see from his reference to Abraham and Sarah and the women of old in verses 5 and 6. And behind this is probably the Genesis creation story, where both men and women are created equals, both reflecting the image of God, but the husband is given a role leading the family and caring for his wife. Jesus certainly refers to the Genesis creation story of men and women when he talks about marriage in the Gospels. But there's a particular situation that has emerged. Now, remember from my background, this is first generation church. These are people who are the first people to hear the gospel. What happens if a couple hears the gospel, hears someone like the Apostle Peter preach the gospel about Jesus, and the wife becomes a Christian, but the husband doesn't? What's the wife supposed to do in that situation? Should she then preach the gospel to her husband at home? Should she say, darling, there's a church meeting up the corner house, why don't we go? Should she try and drag him off to church? Or because she's heard the gospel and the husband hasn't, should she in fact say, well, darling, I can't remain married to you anymore, I have to leave? Well, no, Peter says, don't do any of that. He's speaking here to how a wife is to act now with a non-Christian husband. And she says the way that a Christian wife should act is to keep honouring her husband and to submit to his authority in the same way that all Christians are called to submit to authority. Please note in verse 1 this little phrase, in the same way. It would be easy to overlook this. Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands. Well, in the same way as what, you might ask? This goes back into chapter 2, verse 13, where Peter first uses the word submit, and he uses it to address all Christians when he says, Christians, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority. That was my background point. Christians are to acknowledge and respect the authorities that are above us. In other words, when he comes to chapter 3, verse 1, and he says, in the same way, wives do this, he's actually not asking the wives not to do anything unusual. He's just asking them to do what all Christians are to do, which is, in this case, to submit to their husbands, and in the general sense, all Christians are to submit to authorities. Now, this is part of being a disciple, he says. It's for the Lord's sake. And specifically for the Christian wife, it is a witness to her non-Christian husband. Peter says a God-honoring Christian wife who respects and loves her husband will be inherently beautiful to her husband. She doesn't have to be agitated or anxious about his salvation. That's sort of beyond her in some sense. What she has to do is to be quiet and gentle, to live her life in reverence and purity before her husband, so that her life is like a window into what God is like. She is reflecting through her behaviour something of God. And then her character will have an attraction to her husband that is so much deeper than the outward adornments of clothes and jewellery. Verse 4. Now, it's an incredibly beautiful picture of a marriage, I think, that although it is unbalanced in terms of faith, there is a lovely regard for the husband from the wife and a respectful honouring of him. Now, there's obviously a lot more I could say about this, but I'm going to have to move on and leave some of the further unpacking to my interview. When Peter gets to verse 7 and he addresses husbands, the situation is different. Here he is presuming that not only is the husband a Christian, but the wife is a Christian as well. The picture that Peter presents in verse 7 is of a Christian husband lovingly caring for his Christian wife. The husband will recognise that his wife is equal to him in the sight of God and should be respected and cared for as such. She may be the weaker partner, a reference I think probably not just to physical strength, but also social standing and economic strength. In most cultures, most women are that little bit weaker in these issues, physically, economically, socially. She may be the weaker partner, but in the sight of God, notice this, she is an equal partner in the gracious gift of life. In other words, she's heard the gospel like the husband, she's responded, and she has inherited all God's blessing like the husband. Those of you who know 1 Peter, just think of the language of the previous chapter. The wife, like the husband, is a member of God's chosen people. She is part of the holy nation. Or if you go back to chapter 1, verse 1, she is part of the elect as well as the husband. And if the husband does not treat her like this, then God will not listen to his prayers. Look at the end of verse 7. Now, the picture here is controversial. It's controversial because Peter is telling husbands, in the sight of God, you and your wife are equal. And therefore, you have no room, men, to abuse your authority or take advantage of your wives. Such ungodly behaviour by any Christian man would go completely against everything that Peter is saying. Now, if men are at any risk of getting this wrong, of not understanding what Peter is saying, you only need to go to the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 5, verse 21 and following, where Paul encourages us to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. So husbands to submit to wives, wives to submit to the husbands out of reverence for Christ. And then when he unpacks that, he says to husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. That's a pretty tough call, I think, for any bloke. So in summary, a Christian marriage is a blessing to both husband and wife. If a husband and wife are secure in God's love and in each other's love, then they won't need to compete for authority. They'll be able to acknowledge each other's different roles, accept that each one has different authority, different ways, different strengths that they bring to the family. They'll be able to respect that and defer to each other as appropriate and seek the best for each other, work together to live as the chosen people of God that God has called them to be respectful and affirming of each other. And that, folks, is a very powerful witness to the world. That's part of Peter's big sort of perspective. How do Christian marriages witness to the God that we believe in, to people who don't believe in this God? Now, we'll come back to this a little bit with the interview, but let me just finish by looking at the last few verses, which is about the church. The message that comes through here is that Christians, like husbands and wives, are to live in harmony with one another, and also, there's an added element to this, they're to love their enemies. Now, it was very moving when Shirley was praying before about the persecuted Christians, wasn't it? You know, Christians are being persecuted all around the world, and in the early centuries when Peter was writing to these churches who would be in modern-day Turkey, they were starting to experience the first flushes of Roman persecution. But we're not to respond with hate. He says relationships in the Christian community are to be marked by godliness, respect for authority, respect for one another. When we are insulted, verse 9, Peter just takes it for granted, then we are not to retaliate. Far from being radicals and revolutionaries and overturning society, we are in fact called as Christian communities to be a blessing to society. Praying for our community, praying for those who insult and even persecute us. Peter then finishes by quoting Psalm 34 in verses 10 to 12, reminding us that this is how God wants us to act, by doing good and not doing evil. For if we repay evil with evil, he says, not only will that be a bad witness, but notice what he finishes with. If we do evil in response to evil, what will God do? Or what will God not do? He'll turn his face away from us. In other words, he won't listen to our prayers, something he'd already warned husbands about. So this last section shows us that Christians are to be a blessing to one another in church and a blessing to our wider community. So let me just finish this section by asking this question. How can I be a blessing? If I am married, how can I be a blessing to my spouse? If I'm a Christian, how can I be a blessing to my church? And as a citizen, how can I be a blessing to my community? You see, God has blessed us so much, and we've already learnt about that in the first couple of chapters, and he is now calling us to be a blessing to others. You see that in verse 9. And we live that out in our families, our marriages, our churches, and our communities. Have a little think about that for later. How can I be a blessing? Now, I'd like to invite Stephen and Kate to come and join me. Would you welcome Stephen and Kate to come and join me? So this is Stephen and Kate. Stephen and Kate are up here because they responded to my invitation that I put in contact over the last few weeks, asking if someone would be kind enough to volunteer, and they were kind enough. So just to a little bit of background, how long have you been married?
23 years.
Family?
20-year-old.
17.
17 and a half, 15 and 11.
So four children. You're confirming that in each other's eyes. Yes, we do have four children. And you're both you live here in Blackburn, but you've lived in other parts of the world at different stages, haven't you?
Yes, I was born in Scotland, but grew up most of my life here. Kate grew up here, and for 3 years, about 10 years ago, we lived in New Zealand as well.
Great. Now, we met and chatted during the week, so I know a little bit about Steve and Kate, and I've asked them to tell you some of the things that they've told me. So you told me that you got married quite young. How did you start out as a married couple?
Well, we met in high school, and when we were 19, Steve proposed. I believe we were having a pillow fight at the time. and then we got married when we were 20. And we were very lucky, I think, because we had some people around us who were very caring and offered to meet with us and talk about marriage, talk about the traditional, in particular, traditional service that you would see in the Anglican order of service, and to discuss what that would look like. And because obviously when you're 19, 20 and looking at marriage, it's all very much theory. So I think we're very lucky to have the care and support of quite a few people around us who not only introduced it in a reasonable fashion but also continued to support us in that in the early years. That was really important because
And we looked at this passage from Peter and also from Ephesians 5 and studied that to gain an understanding of what a Christian marriage would look like. I guess we both came from backgrounds with broken marriages. Both of our parents were divorced, and so we wanted to look towards to the Bible to see
find something better,
a model to follow.
That would work.
Now, I suspect one of the issues that this passage raises, especially around the issue of the husband being the head of the family and that sort of thing, one of the issues that it raises is how you as a couple make decisions, and particularly major decisions. Now, you indicated you lived for a while overseas in New Zealand and then you've come back. There are obviously a whole lot of decisions that had to be made for that major transition to work. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you as a couple came to that decision and what sort of issues emerged for you?
Well, I guess we looked at what was best for the family as a whole. It seemed to be the time to move back to Australia. There was a change in circumstances in our lives in New Zealand, and that coincided with the job becoming available in Australia, and I work in a very specialised area, and that job became available. So the decision was made to move back.
By whom?
Well, I guess all the indicators were there, and we discussed all along, we were discussing the indicators. We were prayerful, mindful of what how God would be providing for us. We just kept talking about it. Everything that came up, just kept discussing.
For us, it's a bit difficult to say actually who made the decision, although I would have ultimately made the decision in the end, but we would have talked about it until we came to a oneness of opinion on the subject.
Okay, let me get to another scenario where there might not be quite a oneness of opinion that you've told me about. Kate, you've told me that you would love to own your own house. At the moment, you're living in a rental property, and especially that you'd love to have a garden, but Stephen has said this is not possible at the moment. Can you tell us a little bit about this decision?
First of all, it's not a decision. It's a desire. So it's my desire, which is quite different because that's of the heart, whereas And it's a desire which keeps coming up. So probably every twice a year, we probably have this discussion. And Steve's very patient. And again, we look at all the issues, all the consideration. Primarily for us, what it ends up, we're coming to the same conclusion, which is that it's really important for the children to be at good schools. It's really important that they don't have disruption, because all the studies show that it's actually more beneficial for children. They'll generally do better if they have a stable environment all the way through in terms of schooling. We're near family. We're in a good, fantastic church. Love being here. So we just keep coming back to. I keep coming back to that. So the desire rises, Steve. It's coming up again.
Reminds we'll have this Kate talk. About it, yes.
We'll have this discussion again, and then we'll arrive at the same place again. So it's not that it's a write-off, and it will never be a desire which will ever be met. It's as you were saying, it's a legitimate desire, but at the moment, with the head, it's clearly not the best thing to do.
Steve, any comment?
Well, I think what we like with this decision, as with anyone, what we try and do is refer to the good of the larger group. In this case, it's a family matter, so we're talking about the family. And to some extent, it's a church and community matter as well, since we're part of the church and the community. From time to time, we get our own individual desires, and, you know, this is a strong one for Kate. But acknowledging that desire, and it's a nice desire, but it doesn't... If we approach it as what's the best for the whole, we come to this conclusion, and that resolves it.
Okay. Well, just following on this theme a little bit, that sometimes you disagree, Steve. You told me that in fact some of your discussions with Kate, and these were your adjectives, some of your discussions with Kate can be vigorous, robust, volatile. 1 Peter says you have to respect your wife. How do you respect Kate in the midst of these vigorous, robust, volatile discussions? What does that look like?
Well, it means really genuinely listening to her opinions. While
you're disagreeing with her?
While disagreeing. Robustly. Robustly disagreeing, yes. it means having respecting her means having the honesty to actually argue it, where it's necessary. So that we do understand each other, that I don't hide from her opinions and not face the issue, and give her opinion the respect it deserves. And in many matters, Kate's opinion will be more informed than mine, and will often form the basis for the decision.
Kate, any comment?
Yeah, I suppose just that really, even if the emotions are flaring and those adjectives come into play. Really, what's more important for us, and you know, it's fair to say we've both developed trust in this over the years. What's more important is the unity and moving forward together. So even if the emotions flare up for whatever reason, actually, what's really happening is that, you know, I trust that Stephen and I trust that he's weighing my views in the same way that I am listening and weighing his. So even if, you know, ultimately we disagree in the one time out of 1,000 that we do disagree, by that point we've got the opinions on the table, we're looking at them objectively, it's really got nothing to do, you know, by that time the emotions have settled down and you're really just making a decision about what's the best thing to do. And if in that really rare time when we have a difference of opinion, we'll go with Steve just as a default. Yep. It doesn't happen much.
1 in 1,000. Finally then, either of you, is there anything you've learnt over the years about this passage that we haven't talked about? Is there anything, final comment that you'd like to make?
Well, for me, the model of loving leadership is important. You know, I think it's in some ways easier, or at least on the surface, to sort of coast and not provide leadership. You know, it's easy to sort of let things slide. And I think that the call in this passage and in Ephesians is to provide loving leadership. There's a repeated exhortation for husbands to love their wives. And I think, you know, for men, we can sometimes be a little bit emotionally isolated, and this call on us to keep loving our wives and acting in the best interests of our wives is a big call. And I think the other big thing is that that stands out is that the togetherness in the marriage is more important than getting the decisions right. So that we move forward together on the decision is far more important. A decision right or wrong doesn't really matter. We'll make lots of wrong decisions. We'll keep on making lots of wrong decisions. But we're happy because we move forward together.
Great, thank you. Kate, any last comment?
I think the right decision is the unity. So I think that's the highest aim, really. I really value the balance of reason and love in Steve. And I think that aim of unity and ties into the mystery, you know, when God actually marries you at the ceremony. I think it ties in quite a lot to that. And that's where the peace is. That's where the contentment is. That's where the happiness is. It isn't in the decisions that you make, whether they are the right ones or the wrong ones. I mean, obviously, you're going to do your best to make good decisions, obviously, yeah. And he's very good at, you know, we're both, I think I thought you were undercutting yourself a bit. I think we do make decisions together.
Terrific. Yeah. Would you thank Steve and Kate? It's fantastic. We've got a few moments. If anyone would like to ask any questions, either of myself or I haven't warned Steve or Kate about this, but if you have a question of Steve or Kate, I'm sure they'd be happy to come back. We've probably got about 5 or so minutes.
Hi, Peter. I saw on the internet once on a Christian website that the definition of submitting to your husband was if he asked you to rob a bank, you should do it because God expected us to submit to our husbands, and that was the first call, and if you were actually sinning or breaking the law, that wasn't as relevant. I don't agree with that. I'm assuming
good,
you don't
thank you.
Either. What would you say to someone who's being asked to submit to their husband in a way where they believe that they're breaking God's law or it's perhaps not a helpful area?
Well, I suppose that's where being part of a Christian community is helpful, isn't it? So if you're in a marriage where you feel my husband, so we're talking about the wife here, so if you're the wife and you're feeling that the husband is asking you to do things or do something, maybe not as silly as rob a bank, but asking you to behave in a certain way that you think is wrong, that's when having Christian sisters, you know, Bible study group, growth group, a church, pastors, to check with, go, am I wrong here? Have I misunderstood something? Should I do this? And I think if the wisdom of the community is actually, no, this is not right, then it probably would require a man, maybe someone in authority like a pastor or the growth group leader, to come and have a difficult discussion. Mm.
I read or heard of a lovely definition, I think, of submission. And that is voluntarily giving up my right. So there's an assumption that in the natural world I have a right to do certain things, but I'm going to voluntarily, it has to be voluntary, it can't be forced. And I see a distinction, since the Greek word is different, between submission and obedience. So children are to obey, wives are to submit, and we're all to submit to each other.
Thank you. I'll take that as a comment.
Peter, in the Ephesians passage, wives are called to submit to their husbands, but husbands are called to love their wives. Mm. Do you have any reflection on why wives are asked to submit? I understand what you said about this is all in the context of mutual submission, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. But do you have any reflection on why those two different verbs are used, submit for wives and love for husbands?
Well, that's right. It is in the context of everyone submitting. So we're in Ephesians 5, verse 21 onwards, for those who want to follow this or listening to this on the internet. I think husbands probably need to be told to love their wives. And the model that Paul uses then is of Christ's love. And I think probably husbands find that difficult. As Steve said, sometimes we can be emotionally isolated or emotionally disengaged, and that's not good for our wives. So we could actually be mutually submissive, but we could do that quite unlovingly, mm-hmm. I imagine. And that wouldn't be good for our wives.
Peter, rather than a question, perhaps just an observation. As a nation, we're about to embark on an investigation or inquiry into family violence. And it would seem to me that if we could bring some of these principles into many of the homes where this is happening, this would be a great thing. Over the last couple of months, I've been conducting a series of discussions and DVDs with a lot of young dads who are mainly part of the 4 o'clock service, and they are being encouraged to think about this passage in particular, which the leader of the DVD says, husbands, love your wives with a proper understanding. And if you sort of unpack that a bit, that is a very helpful phrase, I think.
Excellent. So men, if any of you don't understand that, go and talk to Doug after the service. How to love your wife with a proper understanding. This is the sort of thing we do most Sundays. We take a piece of scripture, we go through it, we try and understand it, and we try and apply it so that it's not just something that was written a long time ago, but try and make sense of it. So I was very purposefully having a couple here who are a husband and wife, trying to talk about it from a real point of view, from their perspective, and then the questions allow other people to ask questions and forces me to think more. And so as a community, we're trying to help one another along the way. So you'd be very welcome to join us again next week if you'd like to, if this hasn't scared you. And please do stay afterwards so we can meet you. And I'm quite happy to talk to anybody about anything that's emerged today. And if you need any prayer, if things that have been said have made you think about other things and you'd like someone to pray with you, then do come forward and speak to Ruth at the end of the service.